Cinephile. Nicolas Cage.
Very sincere group of film enthusiasts who are proudly cinephiles.
Oh my goodness! Warren Beatty apparently read the wrong name. This is incredible! Moonlight won Best Picture!
Cinephile. Ethan Hawke.
It's kind of like I'm a professional actor and I direct for love. There's so much in this world that's dividing us, and music is one of those great tools that brings us together.
Paul Rudd.
There's baseball and World War II. It's kind of a dream.
Cinephile, the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast.
All right, yes. Why wasn't I still recording? That would have been gold. Could have run that as the open.
From the top, Jerry Bruckheimer, Timothy Spall, Josh Duhamel, Jeremy Renner, Tony Hale, Namdi Asomugha, Robert Patrick, Richard Lewis, Scott Feinberg, Miles Teller, Rob Reiner, Mark Wahlberg, Margot Robbie, John Ridley, Willem Dafoe, Richard Jenkins, J.K. Simmons, Errol Morris, Tracy Letts, Christy Lemire, Nicolas Cage, Ethan Hawke, Paul Rudd, Max Bredos, Brian Fogle, Tony Parker, Zoe Deutsch, Helen Hunt, Michael Imperioli, Omar Epps, Mark Razzo, Hank Azaria, Fat Jew, Paul Schrader, and David Leitch. What a year! Year number two was on Cinephile. Thanks, as always, to our tremendous talent bookers, Carlton Gillespie leading the way, getting it done for all of us. Executive producer Dan Stanzik, coordinating producer Rick Passmore. I'm Adnan Virk. Thanks so much for making Cinephile a success. This is our two-year anniversary episode. Question for the peanut gallery of Dan and Rick. Of all those guests I mentioned, which of those guests was your personal favorite? Last year, we all agreed, before Ricky was a part of the show, Billy Bob Thornton was probably the best interview. De Niro, obviously the biggest name. Passmore, of all those names, 35 guests, year two Cinephile. Which one did you like the most?
I got to say, I loved Hank Azaria and Richard Lewis. Nice. Those were two of the, I'm a big comedy guy, so those two coming in hot. And obviously, Azaria probably tops that just because of my personal experience. But overall, Richard Lewis, fantastic. Hank Azaria, fantastic.
Danny?
I'm going Max Bredos. I don't think you listed him.
I did.
You did? Okay, I'm going again. Bredos all day for the win.
Max was phenomenal. I agree. He was very funny. It's not have maybe the Q rating of some of the other stars, but listen, huge success now. LAFC, burgeoning. I was going to go with Lewis as well, with Ricky. Also, Willem Dafoe, I thought, was terrific. Gave us 20 minutes of his time. Such a great actor. He was very generous. I also love Timothy Spall. I mean, all these guys were great. Now I look at them all. Rob Reiner, I thought, was really funny. Never thought we'd talk to Rob Reiner. He was great. So thanks, as always, to our illustrious guest list. Our way of giving back, by the way, and thank you to all those who listened last time. Paul Schrader, thankfully, we wanted to get masturbation on a Cinephile episode. He did get that in with his answer about Jake LaMotta in prison in Raging Bull. And Dan, did you listen to the interviews? Thank you to Travis Rockhold, who oversaw both interviews. Did you listen to either interview?
Are you asking on the air or off the air right now?
We'll make it off the air.
Not in their entirety.
Okay, but I just want to know, David Leitch, did you listen to the answer?
I have not gotten to the Atomic Blonde portion yet. Okay. Although I was recently listening to the podcast that I was not a part of.
Okay.
The Tribeca Recap, which was very good by you two.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. We know Jill Haley, who's a very consistent Twitter supporter, did not like that episode. She tweeted and goes, this one was only okay. And
she missed me, right?
And I wanted to write back. I'm like, not enough Dan Stanzik, right? Like she said. But I thought Rick would kill that one. Paris Hilton story. Very good. So, again, thank you to all those who listened. Schrader, Leitch, you can always listen to all the episodes. In fact, all those interviews, you want to listen to them, go ahead and check them out on iTunes or the ESPN app. Please, as always, rank the podcast. I rank my movies at a 4 Maple Leafs. You can rank it at a 5 stars. And post review as well. 2 years in the books. Hopefully, many more years to go. Let us know what you think. Our way of giving back is the quiz. So, yes, Dan Stanzik has dialed up a quiz. You can win Cinephile shirts. Listen, while supplies last, because large is now dwindling, there's very few left. I've got maybe 10 or 15 extra larges, whites, and extra large black, and then that's it. So I'm telling you.
Here's what we got to do. Like, we just got to cozy up next to these marketing folks again that were so kind almost 2 years ago, a little less than 2 years ago, when they got us these T-shirts. Yeah. We haven't really asked for anything again. Like, we've just kind of been this podcast over in the corner that doesn't get anything. No one talks about it. They send out best podcasts of the month. Everyone's got to listen to these podcasts. They never mention us.
No, we're still not getting paid, by the way, in case
you're
curious.
Not getting paid. Yeah, you gave me and Rick new titles today. We're not getting anything out of that other than you giving us titles. So we got to cozy up to them and say, hey, listen, like, what do you think? Maybe some hats, maybe some backpacks, something.
Okay. I like the idea of hats. That's a very good call. I was thinking about that. Yeah, by the way, coming up to the Jay Baruchel was very funny. Speaking of the great guests, you're going to love him.
solid 30 minutes, right, Dan? Like, I've never seen a guest give us this much of his time.
Yeah, two Canadians just start talking, and they never know how to end the conversation because they're too polite and too pleasant.
30 minutes of Jay Baruchel, also review of Fahrenheit 451, Michael Shannon, Michael B. Jordan, new movie on HBO. But the quiz, I love when Dan dials these up. One time, it's very much like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. One time he went very strong, nobody could answer. One time he went very easy, so now we're going to go just right. I think this is the fourth time we've done the quiz.
I think it's the fourth. I think the third yielded zero results. This one, I think, is a little on the easier side after the past experience, which hasn't been so good. So like Adnan said, there's not a lot of T-shirts left. So I think we'll do, what, 10?
Yeah.
Think we can get 10? Should we use a hashtag? Maybe a hashtag Cinephile? That'll be easy for us to filter them on Twitter.
I like it.
Use the hashtag Cinephile. Just give us the answers to these five questions.
Do you want it at my email account or Cinephile ESPN?
Either.
Okay.
Rick can just click on the hashtag and that will filter them so they can either, they don't even have to tag us. They just hashtag Cinephile and we're good.
I love it.
Okay. Question one. Name the Academy Award nominated actor that recognized Adnan at Jimmy Kimmel's post-Oscars party.
It's a good one. Very
okay.
good.
All right. French fries are involved, in case you're curious.
One of our more popular episodes.
Yeah. Question two. What film did Adnan rank as the best since 2000?
Good. I like it.
Yeah, again, you should know all of these. Yep. Like, it's all you.
Right.
Question three. And I'm kind of disappointed with the way you started this episode now, because I thought it was a good question. People were going to have to do their homework, but now you gave them some clues. Name the four actors, keyword actors. Name the four actors that have been guests on the podcast twice. Mm. So, for example, if you were listening to the Tribeca recap, you heard Burt Marcus. That's his last name, right, Marcus?
Yeah, yeah.
He's been on twice, but he's not an actor, so he would not count. Ben Lyons, not an actor, would not count. Four actors
have
been
on twice. Maybe Ben Lyons has an IMDb profile, but you're right, he's not.
I have an IMDb profile from my time on Mike and Mike, trust me, it's a thing. Question four. Speaking of Ben Lyons, who did Ben Lyons recklessly refer to as one of the great American actresses in the past 10 years?
That's the best question you have on this quiz. I'm not going to top that because that was
reckless. Reckless by Ben. I can't wait to talk about her. Reckless.
Yeah. Another word would be hideous, but yes, reckless is correct.
And the final question. Question five. Which actor routinely called Steven Spielberg during the filming of Schindler's List to make him laugh?
Love it.
Five questions.
Excellent quiz.
Hashtag Cinephile.
Hashtag Cinephile. Let us know and fire it up. Dan's segment, Every Man, will be coming up in defense of Rick Passmore coming up. Just one review before we get to the very funny and insightful Jay Baruchel. Fahrenheit 451, currently on HBO, just debuted on Friday. And it's gotten some poor reviews from some, and I think that there's a real dissemination that needs to be made right away. Have you read the book by Ray Bradbury, and have you not read the book? So I may have read the book, but if I have, I don't remember it. So I'm going to count myself as not having read the book. 90% certain I've never read the book. So I may have liked the movie more than those who have read the book and who are trashing this latest adaptation, which, from my understanding, is a tough book to adapt. For those that are unfamiliar, it tells the story of a dystopian future. Is there any other type of future? There's never like a utopian future. It's never a mixed bag future. It's always dystopian. It's dark. It's meddling. There are dark forces at work, and that's the case in Bradbury's vision. And Michael Shannon and Michael B. Jordan play a couple of firemen whose job is to find literature and burn it. That's right. They are the incinerators for all intents and purposes, and they're just trying to eliminate all those with any sort of interest in intellectual discourse and reading books. And there are some images which, I mean, if you're a bibliophile, you'll be offended by seeing all these wonderful works of art being thrown into a big pile and burned. The best news is Michael Shannon, as always, is a beast. The villain in this case, because of course he's playing the villain, I'm not going to spoil, that's not a spoiler alert. Michael Shannon's the bad guy. Of course he is. Although the villain lacks some of his more eccentric villains, I'll say, in the past, but he's still rock solid. As always, he's riveting as a guy who believes that a fireman, this is his job. His job is to eliminate intellectual thought and discourse and to remove that from people's brains, and that books and literature, by their very design, are evil and poisonous. That he believes these are nefarious attempts to affect people. And Shannon is single-minded and convincing in his character in believing that, and that he's trying to help people by doing this. Michael B. Jordan plays his co-host or cohort, and early on is totally in line with this type of thinking, but then has a moment of clarity and decides to flip to the other side. So my first quibble with the story was I didn't necessarily buy his transition. I knew at some point he's going to have to go from being on the dark side to the good side, so to speak. but I didn't necessarily buy that transition. I thought it was a little bit abrupt and could have used a little bit more character development. However, it's very striking visuals. Ramin Barani is the director, and I mean, this the images of fire. I haven't seen this much fire on the screen since maybe Hanks and Castaway. I have made fire. Or Backdraft, again, another way which made fire look so so beautiful in many ways. And I thought they're very striking images, and like I said, of the future and what it, all that it portends. The movie, though, following HBO's movies here, could use a little more length, though, just like my criticism of Paterno, which I thought could have been a bit longer. This one's about an hour 40, could use another 15 or 20 minutes, because, again, I felt it got a little abrupt towards the end. But at the same time, because of Shannon's performance, who, of course, is one of our favorites on Cinephile, hopefully one day, knock on wood, we get him on the podcast, and because of the striking visuals, and Michael B. Jordan, I think, more than holds his own, I'm giving it 2.5 Maple Leafs, fully understanding those who have read the book probably will dislike the movie, and it's getting tepid reviews as it is. Ricky, did you have a chance to watch it? HBO just debuted this Friday.
Haven't watched it yet, wanted to, and actually started reading the book because of it, and never got to finish it because I'm a horrible reader. But from what you've said and from what I got out of the first half of the book, it's a very short novel. It's not that long.
Right.
So what I'm gathering out of it is it would be very difficult to adapt because there really isn't much true overall character development out of what's needed for the plot.
Right.
So I can see where you would say it's hard to develop. There's the character development's not there. Certain things are hit or miss with it. So I'll watch it and see, you know, I'll watch it soon and see how it is, and then attempt to go back and get the book from the library and finish the 90 pages I have left.
Dan, our most well-read member of the Cinephile team. You have clearly read Fahrenheit 451.
I have not read the book, but you had me at Michael Shannon, villain and intense.
Clearly, for anybody who is like-minded like me and Dan and Rick, that will be enough to sell the movie, quite frankly. I had not read the book. I'm like, oh, Shannon's in it? Oh, he's a villain? Oh, he's crazy? Of course I'm going to watch this. Hour 40? Piece of cake. All right, that is Fahrenheit 451. I would have more movies to review. In case you want to know my review of Deadpool 2, which was on the previous podcast, 3.5 Maple Leafs. How crazy is the world now, by the way? It opened at $125 million, and they go, a bit of a soft opening. Are you kidding? Like, the movie made last time $650 million. It opens at $125, they go, need a little more.
It opened about $7 million less than the first Deadpool, and I think that's why people were kind of standoffish about that, because
sequel opening is always traditionally
sequel
better,
opening,
and then it falls.
It's going to go better, but right. you got to remember, too, they're knocking off Infinity War, which is on pace to almost get close to breaking what right. Black Panther just did, and also getting close to pushing Solo. $2 billion worldwide. So you have Solo, and it's a hard R, which means you're going to get less box office numbers from that. So people have to kind of take certain things with a grain of salt. Yeah. They're trying to blame the superhero fatigue, like you said.
Right.
But at the same time, $135 million opening for this just domestic is still very strong. It's probably not going to hold on to it because of Solo opening next week. But at the same time, for a hard R, very niche type of superhero film, that's still very impressive, and it's probably still going to do $500 million domestic at the end of the run.
Yeah. It's a little disappointing, but it happens. First Reformed also, I reviewed 3.5 Maple Leafs. People were asking where to find it. It's in limited release right now. Brian Koppelman, who's one of the guys who works on Billions, he tweeted, First Reformed is the best movie of 2018, and he's going to have Paul Schrader on his podcast. I was not aware of Koppelman's podcast. Maybe it's a Billions-type podcast, but apparently he's going to get Schrader, so I'll make sure to listen to that for First Reformed. That's where you can find it. Otherwise, my movies have been focused on the Greenwich Film Festival. I'm going to be a part of the jury of the Greenwich Film Festival, another feather in the cap. I have to watch 8 movies before June 1st. I've watched 6 of them. I'll be quite honest. 1 was outstanding. A couple were all right. 3 were dreadful. So let's just hope we power through these last 2 and see how that goes. We're hoping to get Mark Teixeira, my buddy, who's the guy who hooked me up with this. Yes, that Mark Teixeira, the Yankees baseball great, who is on the board of the Greenwich Film Festival and thus had me involved as part of the jury. It's tough for me to say with a straight face. I'm on the jury of an actual film festival. I cannot wait. Deliberations. I'm picturing like a 12 Angry Men scenario. 2 other guys. I got their credentials. Like, what if we start fighting about this? Because I'm telling you right now, if they pick one of the 3 movies as their best, I'm like, no, I'm not leaving this room until we pick not one of those 3 movies. Like, it doesn't have to be my number 1, but if they pick one of those 3, and I'm telling you right now, they're very artsy. If these guys are like, no, I thought the French film was so, I'm like, no, that's garbage. That's exactly the kind of movie that wins at film festivals that shouldn't. No person would watch this movie unless they're on a film festival jury. I can't wait for stories from that. June 1st, the Greenwich Film Festival, and my deliberations from it. But for now, Jay Baruchel, very funny, very entertaining, and very Canadian. He's got stories from Tropic Thunder, Million Dollar Baby, Goon 1 and 2. He's got it all. Take a listen now on Cinephile. A real pleasure to welcome to Cinephile the great Jay Baruchel. His new documentary is called Celtic Soul. I encourage you to check it out. We'll talk to Jay all about it, but his credits also include The Hysterical, This Is the End, How to Train Your Dragon, Goon 1 and 2, Tropic Thunder, Million Dollar Baby. He does it all. He's a huge sports fan, particularly the Montreal Canadiens. Jay, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So I grew up in Kingston. I was born in Toronto. I grew up in Kingston. One of my best friends, Jeff Lovelock's a diehard Montreal Canadiens fan. So whenever when I saw This Is the End, I was so happy because I know you're such a huge Habs fan, and immediately your character is, of course, repping Montreal. So now you're the favorite actor of him and so many others. But before we get to that movie specifically, how did a Canadian make it big in Hollywood? I know that, you know, listen, we're known for being funny, and we've got a great lineage of comedians, but how did you specifically make that transition?
Oh, well, in my case, it was down to sort of two gigs that I got. One was I had sort of two scenes in this movie, Almost Famous, that came out back in 98 or 99. I was in grade 11 in Montreal when I got that job, and they flew me and my mom down to L.A. and then New York, and then and I got to work with a bunch of really amazing actors and be directed by Cameron Crowe, and he's kind of the guy that found me up here. Basically, flash forward a year or two, and I'm in CJEP in Montreal, and twiddling my thumbs, sort of going through the motions, not real psyched about being there, and got a phone call at home at my mom's house from a casting director in LA who had seen me in Almost Famous and was casting a show that at that point was called the Untitled Judd Apatow Project, which would then go on to become Undeclared, a TV show called Undeclared, and that was kind of the start of all of it. And I went from being a pasty-faced 18-year-old CJEP student in Montreal to a pasty-faced 18-year-old lead of an American network TV show in a matter of days. So, I'd say it kind of all started with that.
I love the grade 11 reference, telltale sign that you're Canadian. And also the fact that, like you said, if you mention French immersion, I'm really going to feel like I'm at home again. But getting hooked up with Judd and those guys, like that's what I find fascinating. Seth Rogen, fellow Canadian, I believe he's from Vancouver. But the fact that once you got, it's interesting, right? Like you look back now and go, well, yeah, you guys are so talented and so funny, and Judd's brilliant, and you and Franco and Rogen, I'm like, yeah, I got it. Like, how could that not work? But it seems fortuitous now to say, you know, if that didn't happen, where would your career path have landed, right?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, so it's weird. I didn't expect to, I thought I'd have quit acting at that point, because I started when I was 12, and I was doing a bunch of, like, kid shows in Canada from the age of, like, 12 onwards. But my goal was always to be a director. And so I figured at 18, as the work kind of started to dry up for me back home, because I was, like, no longer anything close to a cute kid, and nothing remotely resembling a man. It was just sort of a weird, in a sort of pubescent nether region of my life. And so I figured if I had any money saved up, however much money I had saved up, I'd take it and hopefully go to film school and then find a gig working at a video store and then just write movies, write action movies and horror movies in my spare time. That's kind of where I thought I'd end up being. And yeah, it was pretty profound shift in my life and moment in my life to get that gig and to get to work with all those people. And you know, I'm 36 now, and we did the pilot of Undeclared when I was 18, and yeah, it is a pretty neat looking back with hindsight at who all was around in those days.
Well, you mentioned the fact that you worked with Cameron Crowe in Almost Famous. It's interesting because it's only after I'd seen This Is the End that I remembered. I'm like, oh my God, Jay Baruchel's a Million Dollar Baby. Like, I went back and you were great in that movie. And that movie won Best Picture, and working with Clint. And I mean, I couldn't imagine for you at that point, you work with Clint and Morgan Freeman and Hilary Swank. And that's a tough character to play, right? Because you could fall in this trap of playing this simple guy who's this, you know, he's made fun of and ridiculed. But there's a lot of heart to that character in that movie. Tell me about that experience.
Thanks, man. That was nice of you to say. It was a pretty big one. There was a pretty there are every audition is big, but then there are certain ones that are, like, especially big. And when, you know, you have the chance to maybe get hired by Clint Eastwood, that's a huge one. And I remembered, I just sort of like, when I heard the character was meant to be from Texas, I breathed a sigh of relief because in like 1979, 1980, my mom's sister moved down to Texas and got married and had a bunch of had three sons. And the eldest of which is only like a few, like maybe a year younger than me. So this is all to say that I've grown up around that accent throughout my life. And so I was like, I feel like I can figure this guy out. And I remember auditioning for it and being the only guy in the waiting room that wasn't wearing like workout clothes. some people seem to think like if you're auditioning for a construction worker, you have to show up in a hard hat, you know? And so there was all these guys in hoodies and shorts with towels around their necks. And I was like, I didn't get that email. I don't know if this bodes well. Yeah. Either I'm a huge or all of them are. And then I auditioned and then I didn't hear anything for months and months. And I just assumed, oh, that's that. And then I was at a friend of mine's house, in Montreal, and him and his brother, their parents were away, and they were in the process of rendering some rotten weed into hash oil on their stovetop when I got a phone call from my agent in the States saying, hey, you like Mystic River? Do you want to be in Clint's next movie? And I was like, holy. And then all of a sudden there I was on set with Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman. And I, for whatever reason, I'm anxious in all aspects of my life except for on set. And except for that day, because I was very, very scared, because I was like I said, there's Morgan Freeman and there's Hilary Swank and there's Clint Eastwood. And, you know, I was scared because I was overcome with this like real, real strong sense of I don't want to screw this up. Because, you know, no person that I've ever worked for up to that point or since would be half as impressive to my granddad as Clint Eastwood. And, you know, my granddad passed away in 92. And, you know, I'm a big fan of David Cronenberg and Cameron Crowe and Judd Apatow and Ben Stiller. And I like, you know, I'm a massive fan of all these guys, and I've been blessed to work with all of them. But the only person that would have been like, holy crap, to my granddad was Clint Eastwood. And so this is all to say, like, I really don't want to screw this up. And but I learned so much on that first day, because after every take, I'd say, was that all right, sir? Was that all right, sir? And he'd always say, yeah, it was fine. Yeah, that was fine. And I'm like, gosh. And like I start imagining the scenario behind the scenes of a flurry of phone calls of like, where the hell did we find this kid? Find me someone who knows what the hell they're doing. And then I guess Morgan Freeman saw me kind of stressing out a bit, and he leaned over and said, if he doesn't say anything, it means he likes it. And I was like, oh, that's right, because he's the director. What difference does it make how I feel? Like, if he's hired me and he's hired all of us and he thinks we've done the job he's hired us to do, that's that. And that really saved me and allowed me to keep acting for years and years and years, because I just sort of, like, understood this profound truth that all I need to do is trust the director. And a lot of actors have a tendency to keep asking for takes and, oh, I can get there. I know I can do better. I know I can do it. Well, if the person who's editing and shooting and envisioning the entire thing thinks you've done what they need you to do, that should be the end of it. So yeah, it was pretty incredible, man.
And one of the coolest things I've heard about Clint as a director is that he doesn't say action, right? He just says whenever you're ready, which I think is such a cool thing.
Yeah. And bare minimum of rehearsal, you know, you rehearse the scene, or block it maybe twice tops. And then he averages around three takes per shot. And so it's a really, like, he just has a complete trust in the people, in himself and the people that he's put together on any given set. And there's no need to belabor stuff if he knows that he's gotten the moment that he needs. And I think that a lot of people, when you're on a set and there goes north of 7-10 takes plus, it's hard not to to assume that that means that the person doesn't know what the director doesn't know what they're looking for. And Eastwood is a living master, one of the greatest living masters in cinema. And And so to get to be there, and yeah, it's an incredibly rewarding process, but also a really palatable one, because you get there at like 9 a.m., 9:30, which is really reasonable. And I was eating supper in my hotel room by 7 every single night. Like, they finished that movie 3 days or 2 days ahead of schedule, which is just unheard of. Like, so yeah, one of the greatest, most edifying, important working experiences of my life.
Oh, it's really well expressed. We're talking with Jay Baruchel, his new documentary, Celtic Soul. I encourage you all to check it out. Speaking of, by the way, first off, we got to get this to Michael Mann, because if one take works, he'll do 53 takes. So he's going to figure out how to shorten this down. Hank Azaria was like, dude, it was unbelievable on Heat. He wouldn't stop. I'm like, come on, man, we're good. I just read Nick Nolte's book, and you mentioned Ben Stiller. He said Tropic Thunder was crazy because if you're going to make a movie satirizing Vietnam, you end up actually making a war film. And it actually, with the pyrotechnics and all that going on there, it wasn't necessarily... And Nick said it was a fun experience because Ben's so great and you guys are all good actors. But he goes, it was intense. It was like making Platoon because you're making fun of Platoon.
Oh, yeah, 100%. They spared nothing. And on that movie, Ben and everyone took the action as seriously as anything else. And that's why I think it is as strong and sturdy as it is, and why I can't name a whole bunch of other movies that I'm confident to say will be just as relevant 20 years from now as they are today. You know, I think it'll be one of those classics that'll be on TV forever. And part of that is the like painstaking care that was made, that it was made with, you know, like that we shot that movie for over 6 months. You know, we treated it like an epic. And to that end, you know, Ben hired John Toll, who shot Thin Red Line and Braveheart. And so the movie and all of the pyrotechnics and the gunplay, almost all of that is practical, old school practical Apocalypse Now style as well. And my first day of work on that movie, we were shooting the opening kind of battle sequence that opens the movie, and we had 50 stunt performers, 50 extras, 24 actors, two practical Huey helicopters, and the whole thing was just covered in squibs, and it was. Man, it was like the most fun I've ever had on a film set. It's like, it was such a combination of everything I love. You know, I grew up playing cops and robbers and playing Army when I was a kid, playing G.I. Joe. And here I was getting to do it as a grown up, you know, having a rifle, an M16 at my side with a full magazine full of ammo every single day. But on top of that, I'm getting to work with some of the funniest people on earth and do this really weird, uncommon movie that, like, I don't know. It's a movie that has no sort of, you can't be like, you know, it's like this meets that. Tropic Thunder kind of defies comparison. And once again, I was like just incredibly lucky to be there for half a year and get to watch it get made.
Very Canadian of you to have that humility, but trust me, you were an indispensable part of that movie. And speaking of great comedies, I'm telling you, This Is the End. I had it on my top 10 of that year. I think it's one of the funnier movies of the decade. What I'm curious about is this. It's obvious you guys have great chemistry, you and Rogan and Franco and everyone together. My curiosity is always this. When I see those movies, how much of it is ad-libbed and how much of it is on the page? Because my instinct is to say, oh, they're all buddies, so they're riffing. But then I said, no, maybe Danny McBride actually did have that all in the script and he committed it to memory and he executed it flawlessly.
It depends what set and what movie. On that one, we had like pretty good understanding of the sort of structure of the story and the how it needed to start, how it needed to continue, and how it needed to end. Now on the way there, it was wide open to ad lib. So I'd say that like the kind of structure of the movie and the story was very much written and was understood and figured out, you know, before we shot it, as you're supposed to do with most movies. I'd say like 80%+ of the words that people say in the movie are ad libs or we came up with on set. So it's kind of a combination of the two. And I feel compelled to mention that like ad libs also really only work if the people making them understand the scene that they're shooting in the context of the whole story. And, you know, it can't just be a guitar solo for guitar solo's sake. It has to be funny. But being funny is one box out of, like, three or four that need to be checked. Thank you for saying it's a very, very funny movie, because I agree. I really like that one.
Oh, yeah, and the one thing about Judd, too, you always get this with his movies, is that, okay, fine, for some people they find it sophomoric or vulgar, but there is, like, genuine heart in there. Like, that I always say, like, they're actually really good movies, and I'll fight to the death of who disagrees with that. Judd Apatow makes excellent movies, which happen to be very funny.
I think so, and I think Seth and Evan, you know, coming up in that school and learning so much from him, take that approach with This Is the End in a big way. You know, I think that it's funny, but the reason why it's memorable is because you end up giving it.
Yeah.
You know, there's plenty of things are funny. Plenty of movies have one joke that's strong or a few scenes that are strong. But those are movies you fall asleep to on the airplane. You know, the movie that you remember and you kind of get, you know, feel a strong connection to and the movie you keep thinking about years later, that's one where something important happened. And you know, the hardest guy out there needs something to affect his heart for him to give a shit about it. Simple as that.
We'll get to Celtic Soul in just a second. My kids will be very annoyed with me, Jay, if I don't ask you about How to Train Your Dragon. Tell me, listen, something about Canadians and voiceovers, right? Will Arnett's obviously a great Miss Arena. You've had a huge success with this. Tell me about How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah, and I had also made mention that the director of the How to Train Your Dragon movies, Dean DeBlois, is from Elmer, Quebec.
Nice.
Sheraton College graduate. I was in Hawaii on the Isle of Kauai shooting Tropic Thunder when I basically got a call saying, the DreamWorks Digs doesn't hate what you're doing every day, and they'd like you to audition for this cartoon movie. And so I went in on a day off on like a Sunday flash forward a decade later and I'm part of this like global franchise that is a lot of people's favorite movies of all time so I'll be perfectly honest, I was just like lucky enough to fall ass backwards into my Star Wars. You know, it's been so cool because my job is to, you know, say 5 or 6 times a year for 3 years, I go in and record for 2 hours. And then after that at the end of that 3 year period, this incredible work of art is released and my voice is in it. And, it's, you know, means a significant amount to people across the world. And it's especially cool because I know firsthand that how much there's nothing in my adult life that I've liked as much as the stuff that I liked when I was a kid. When you're a kid and you like something, you like it with the entirety of your heart, and it means everything to you, and you remember it fondly, fondly, fondly throughout the rest of your life. In fact, it often sort of pushes you to become the adult you're going to become. And I know that I'm a part of movies that are that for a bunch of kids already, and it's really, really neat that, like, as the more years go by and these kids start to grow up, it just is like more and more and more people across the world have this movie that I'm a part of, these movies I'm a part of, as real significant parts of their lives, and that's a really, really cool thing.
Speaking of significant parts of your lives, Celtic Soul, your new documentary. This is trading on your passion for soccer. Like I said, I knew the hockey stuff, but tell me all about this and where people can find this terrific documentary.
Oh, gosh. Well, thank you very much for saying it's terrific. My sort of other great sports athletic love is Glasgow Celtic Football Club. And for those who don't know, it's a very old-ass soccer team in Glasgow, Scotland, one of really one of Scotland's two most famous clubs. The rivalry between Glasgow Celtic and Glasgow Rangers is just Google it, and it's the stuff of legend and myth. And I've had a deep connection to this team for a long time, given sort of its origins and what it means to the sort of people that it means stuff to. And it was sort of my mom's family are predominantly Irish Catholic, and this was a team that was born of the potato famine when the streets of Glasgow were flooded with Irish immigrants fleeing famine and seeking a better life. And Celtic was a gift to them, a soccer team created by the Catholic Church to keep everybody busy and occupied and out of trouble. And to this day, it still has a profound connection to charity and to all that stuff. And it's just hard not to sort of fall in love with the romance of Celtic. And anyway, so this movie is a sort of road trip with, following me and my friend Owen O'Callaghan, soccer journalist from Ireland. And we sort of go on this road trip starting in Montreal and ending up in Glasgow. And along the way, we learn a whole bunch about the history of Celtic, as well as my family's ancestry, our story. We sort of follow this one kind of interesting thread of one of my great-granddads or great-great-granddads leaving this small town in Ireland called Westport and making his way to Canada, and then we actually get to go there. And so, anyway, it's also a great – there's also a great deal of swearing in it because it's Owen and I in a car for days on end. But, yeah, hopefully it's entertaining, good music, some good sport, love letter to the nexus of sport, culture, and history. And yeah, right now, I know in the States, you can get it on iTunes.
Perfect. That's an excellent sell for it. Check out Celtic Soul on iTunes. Now it's time to get really Canadian. So, mm-hmm. Goon 1 and 2, terrific movies. My old buddy James Duthie. So, Duthie, I used to work at TSN. I went to Ryerson, and then I worked at TSN behind the scenes. So, Duthie's first ever shift, he can corroborate this, I worked prompter for him, so he was all of his considerable success to me. I want you to confirm this, Jay. Gino Retta turned down the role. Michael Landsberg turned down the role. Duthie did it, but he was a dreadful actor, and you had to save him in post. Is that true or not?
There's about 14 other old white guys you skipped over before we landed at Duthie. In fact, Duthie paid to be in the movie. Absolutely not. James Duthie, we wrote that part for him. my writing partner Jesse and I are massive TSN fans, and he's been a significant part of our Boxing Day through New Year's traditions for the bulk of our adult lives. And for people that don't know what the hell I'm talking about, I'm talking about the World Juniors,
hockey, yeah.
And it's the most exciting hockey there is, in my opinion. But anyway, Duthie was kind enough to give us his time, and we got to go shoot on the TSN studio in Scarborough, which is real cool. So I wish I could give you the satisfaction of saying that we had to suffer James Duthie, but the movie's much better for it, and he was our number one choice.
Well, Michael Landsberg, I just spoke to yesterday on TSN radio, course of OTR fame. He says, by the way, he's a big fan of you. I know you've been on OTR before. He swears that he was offered the role first. So Landsberg is either lying or Duthie's lying. I don't know which.
I don't. That sounds like a bit of broken telephone. It might very well. Someone might have reached out to Landsberg first, but it wasn't me. Duthie, I've only had eyes for James Duthie.
I tell my buddies here in America, he's like Canada's Bob Costas. He can do it all, and obviously
he's an institution. He's an institution because he's the real, actual institution that CBC and everyone else keeps trying to convince us that Don Cherry is. But James Duthie is the guy that we actually like and is actually on in every household in the country.
All right, I want you to rank the following Canadian items: Export cigarettes, coffee crisp, poutine, and Mordecai Richler.
Oh, good Lord. That's a hard one, boss. Well, probably.
Dave's from Montreal, everybody. So if you're from Montreal, Mordecai Richler is an institution, literary icon. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have to start with, I go Richler. Expert A's are pretty great. Then Coffee Crisp, and then Poutine.
You're a diehard Montreal Canadiens fan. I'd like you to rank the following four. Number one's going to be easy, obviously, Patrick Roy. But since you're 36, I'm also including Mats Naslund, Craig Ludwig, and Stéphane Richer.
All right. I'd have to go, I'll go Roy, Richer, Naslund, Ludwig.
I thought you'd have a soft spot for the defensive defenseman of Craig Ludwig, but that's probably accurate.
And Stéphane Richer was one of my dad's favorite players, and worth noting the last Montreal Canadian to score 50 goals in one season of hockey.
Very true, very true. And lastly, Canadians have the funniest people: John Candy, Mike Myers, Phil Hartman, Jim Carrey. You don't have to tell me which ones you think are the best, but for personal influence or maybe a soft spot you have: John Candy, Mike Myers, Phil Hartman, Jim Carrey.
Well, John Candy, there's only ever been one, and there will never be we will never see his like again. He gets, I think, unfairly lauded in with other people sometimes, and I really think he had an energy unto himself. And there's like he found a way to make being nice funny. And that's a pretty special thing. In addition to his superhuman abilities and his stature and everything, he's like a force in nature. But the really cool thing was that like he found a way to make being nice funny, which is I think really really cool and uncommon. Jim Carrey is like, there's nobody my age that didn't grow up watching Ace Ventura and The Mask on repeat, and so his influence cannot be overexpressed. Phil Hartman, I mean, holy crap, that was like, I remember when he died, and I was a kid, and that was a big one for me, because as big of an SNL fan as I was, and still am an even bigger Simpsons fan. And he was somebody I was always proud to claim some degree of patriotic ownership over. Hartman is like, nobody did what he did. And the fact that he has as many iconic Simpsons characters as he does SNL characters is a testament to his abilities. And then Mike Myers, you know, he's a sort of, there's an argument to be made that he's Canada's Peter Sellers, and a sincere, true artist in the craft of comedy, and someone who's always worn his roots and his culture on his sleeve, and aside from the rather ridiculous idea that
the Leafs would win the cup, Love Guru.
There would be the Leafs would win the cup like they did in Love Guru, But by the way, we could talk for 7 hours about what's wrong with the Love Guru, but by far its greatest thing is the sort of Leafs LA final that he predicted would happen. Given the era that I grew up in my age, I can't overstate how important Myers is. Like, my dad took my friends and I to see Wayne's World in the theater on my 10th birthday. So there it is.
That's wonderfully expressed. Last one for you, and I promise, Jay, thanks for being so generous with your time. Because I know you're such a big Habs fan and a hockey fan, because when people ask you the best sports movies, I always mention The Rocket, which is about Maurice Richard, and not enough people have seen it. I'm sure you've seen it. Can you just tell the audience how great it is?
It's a very, very good flick. Yeah, it's an important story. I really, really well acted, and it's a beautiful look at. I think personally, I think the hockey could have been a bit more exciting. But
true.
Anyway, that's that. But I'm a bit biased when it comes to filming hockey. And what movies have done it best? But The Rocket is Roy Dupuis just. Basically, he gets possessed by the Rocket. So it's not a performance by an actor so much as you're getting to watch somebody channeling the Rocket, and you understand why he's the Babe Ruth of hockey, and the sort of watching that movie, you get a really good sense of why the Habs aren't like any other hockey team. That most hockey teams, the sole masters that they have to answer to are victory, right? Most hockey teams, the only thing that's important is winning. And the Habs have so many cultural and political connections and ramifications to everything they do. And so it just makes for the experience of being a Habs fan a very weighty one. And you get a really good sense of that in the Rocket.
The talented and very funny Jay Baruchel, Million Dollar Baby, Tropic Thunder, Goon 1 and 2, How to Train Your Dragon, This is the End, and Celtic Soul, currently available on iTunes. Tremendous stuff here on Cinephile, man. Hopefully, one day you come to ESPN, we can actually break bread and have some poutine together. But thanks so much for the time, man. I really appreciate it.
I look forward to it, bud. Thank you so much for having me. Nice to meet you.
If you're looking for a reason to work with a local GEICO agent, I have all of them. Because I'm the voice of reason. Reason 1, GEICO agents could help you save on more than car insurance. Reason 2, they can help tailor your policy to fit your needs. Reason 3, they're local. And 4, they're local. Yes, I already said that, but it's still a good reason.
And if you're looking for more ways to save, your local GEICO agent could help with more than just your auto insurance. Stop by or give them a call today. They're here to help.
So I vividly remember watching the World Series in 2009. Mark Teixeira was a part of that Yankees championship. And now who would have thought, just 9 years later, he's coming on Cinephile and we're boys because he works for ESPN and we have a great time on Baseball Tonight. Tex, thanks so much for the time today, man.
Great to be here, my friend. Thank you for having me.
So Greenwich Film Festival, improbably, I am on the jury. There's 8 movies I have to watch. I've watched 6 of them so far, and it's all because of you that I have this very plum gig. This is very cool. Who can say they're a part of a film jury? Please tell me how you first got hooked up with the Greenwich Film Festival.
Yeah, so the Greenwich International Film Festival was founded in 2014 by some friends of ours in Greenwich that really wanted to kind of bring film to the forefront and the social issues that that can really make a difference in our country through film. And they had this idea that, you know, Greenwich is kind of a sleepy town and it's close to Manhattan, but, you know, wanted to do something on their own from a film standpoint. And hatched this idea of promoting the Greenwich International Film Festival to get, you know, people's words out there, to get people's stories out there, to help make changes around the world. And it's been really cool.
And that's the beauty of this. Like you said, you're spreading film, you're spreading cinema, and there's so many great film festivals out there. Tex, obviously Cannes is very famous south of France. The Toronto Film Festival, we know about, Tribeca, et cetera. When it comes to Greenwich, and you're trying to kind of balance between, you know, really hardcore cinephiles who are going to watch foreign films, independent movies, and then a festival which is more about mainstream movies, how do you think the programmers decide the selection of films?
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, there are hundreds and even thousands some years of films that come through our programmers. And some of them, honestly, are awful and are unwatchable. But there are so many great films out there that you just need the right group of people to watch, the right audience. And I think what we try to do is we are very kind of honest that these films, a lot of them are pushing, you know, social justice agendas, pushing stories that people maybe, you know, are uncomfortable telling. There's a lot of stories that will completely break your heart. A few will uplift you, but again, very, very socially conscious, and maybe not a film festival that people from around the world will know now. But hopefully as we get going, people will say, hey, did you hear about that great film that premiered at the Greenwich Film Festival? And someday we'd like to get there.
Talking right now, Mark Teixeira, Greenwich Film Festival is coming up. When people think about experiences at festivals, Mark, exactly what you said. You say, I remember watching Pulp Fiction. I remember watching whatever film it was and the reaction it was in the crowd. Is there a film you can remember specifically with regards to Greenwich, either you were a part of or somebody you were close to who said, man, you should have seen the audience reaction watching this movie?
Oh, man. That's a good question. You actually, one of the cool things that I got to do was we got to be the second filming, the premiere of the Entourage movie,
nice.
Which is not what we do at all. I mean, the Entourage movie was kind of that fun, you know, bro type movie. And what we got to do is basically show people that, hey, we can bring in someone like Entourage. We can bring in Doug Allen. We can have fun. and people get really excited about the festival. I think we did that in probably April or May. The festival was in June. This is a few years ago. And so when people showed up to Entourage, they got excited about who the type of people we could bring into the festival. And then, you know, we're able to maybe gain a little bit more traction, you know, because of bringing in a type of film.
That's awesome. Greenwich Film Festival is taking place. I'm going to be there at the opening party June 1st. But the pass of the festival currently available now May 31st to June 3rd. Tickets are on sale. Go to Greenwich. That's GreenwichFilm.org and learn all about the film festival. For you specifically, Tex, as a movie guy, because I always wonder, I'm curious, ball players, obviously you guys work so hard at your craft, but then there's downtime. There's a reason why starting pitchers like Mark Mulder and John Smoltz are such good golfers. A guy like you, a first baseman, day in, day out, playing, where did the love of movies come and how were you able to develop it?
On planes, Adnan. Oh my goodness. We flew cross country so many times, especially when I was in the West. I mean, I spent the first 5 years of my career in the AL West with the Rangers and the Angels. Because of that, we were flying cross country all the time, and I would have hours and hours and hours. And so buddies on the team would just start talking about, hey, have you watched this movie? Have you watched that movie? As I got older in my career, you started having the TVs in the headrests, right, of the planes. And you could kind of go through, you know, 40 or 50 movies if you wanted to on the plane. And I started watching just different types of movies. You know, I like indie flicks. I like the coming of age. I'm a sucker for, you know, a high school graduation party type movie or, you know, a kid that studies abroad for the summer or something like that. I'm a sucker for those type of movies because they don't get the play. They don't get the big Oscar awards that everyone else gets, but they can be really cool movies.
So coming-of-age movies are a personal favorite. I'm guessing Good Will Hunting is your favorite movie.
It's so good. I mean, that movie, everyone wants to think that they're that smart or wants to think that, like, they can be this, like, tough guy that can take on the world. We can't. And, man, we're regular dudes, and you know, we try to do our best and we try to, you know, add a little bit for our kids or something like that. But watching Good Will Hunting, it just kind of makes you feel like, hey, there's some cool stuff happening in this world.
My producer, Dan Stanzik, loves the film Lady Bird. I don't know if you're on board with Lady Bird. I liked it a lot, Tex. I don't know if you've seen it, but what was your favorite movie from last year?
Ooh, favorite movie from last year would have been... I got to say Dunkirk.
Nice.
It took me a while to watch it because I'd heard mixed reviews, right?
Mm-hmm.
The cinematography, just the, like, the shots of the beaches and how normal people thought it was to be standing on a beach and just have bombs coming down and looking around just being like, okay, it really put me there. You don't see a lot of movies that you can actually put yourself on that beach. And that was one of them. So that was a pretty cool one.
Yeah, Christopher Nolan, incredible director. Also, you remember, as I mentioned, the 2009 Yankees won the World Series. Which actor would play you if they made a movie about that team?
Man, I'm kind of boring, Ed. Man, I'm not one to fly, fly by the seat of my pants. I'd probably say it would be like a George Clooney type guy. good looking, but quiet confidence. I'm not sure if George Clooney can swing a baseball bat, but if he could, he'd be great for the 09 World Series.
He's allegedly a really good baseball player. At least he was. I know now he plays pickup hoops all the time. Clooney got a tryout with the Cincinnati Reds, which was his hometown team. In fact, I've never seen George Clooney happier. He was on Ellen, and they brought out Joe Morgan and Johnny Bench, and literally he looked like a kid in a candy store. So you know what?
That is awesome.
Yeah.
This is how did you know that, Adnan? I mean, that's like, no one knows that. You got these nuggets, man, that no one else has.
I appreciate it. It's a random factoid, which really has no use anywhere else, Tex, except for my podcast, which you know.
Oh, that's great.
Greenwich Film Festival is coming up May 31st to June 3rd. I will be on the jury. Lauryn Hill, opening night performer, should be awesome. Mark Teixeira is a part of the board. You can always see his great work on ESPN on Baseball Tonight. Tex, thanks so much for the time, man. I appreciate it.
And man, this was a blast. Thanks, buddy.
All right, guys, let's be real here. I'm turning 40 in a couple of months, and 66% of men lose their hair by age 35. All right? I know it's not the details you want to hear, but it's true. I started to lose my hair late 20s, receding hairline. And when you start to notice hair loss, it's too late. It's easier to keep the hair you have than to replace the hair you've lost. Seriously, look in the mirror right now. Check out your hairline. Slowly starting to move backwards? Any bald spots yet? How are you going to feel when it gets worse? You want a bald spot to pop up? You want the hairline to go back even more? Why do guys turn to weird solutions when they can turn to medicine and science, or even worse, do nothing and just say that's life? I'm telling you right now, here's the solution. 4hims.com. It's a one-stop shop for hair loss, skin care, and other wellness supplements for men. Hims connects you with real doctors and medical-grade solutions to treat hair loss. Well-known generic equivalents to name-brand prescriptions to help you keep your hair. That's the key. You can't grow more hair, but you can keep what you got. No snake oil pills or gas station counter supplements. This is prescription solutions backed by science, and there's no waiting room. There's no doctor visit. No one's going to see you. Just go to 4hims.com. So easy. Answer a few quick questions. A doctor's going to review it and prescribe you, and the products are shipped directly to your door. I'm telling you, they could not make this easier for you. So order now. My listeners get a trial month of Hims for just $5 today, right now, while supplies last. See website for full details. This would cost hundreds if you went to the doctor or a pharmacy. Go to 4hims.com/cinephile. That's forhims.com/cinephile. CINEPHILE. forhims.com/cinephile.
A Hollywood career spanning decades. And the tales of Tinseltown are told here. Inside the Lion's Den with Ben Lyons.
Wow, what an intro. Wow, thanks so much for having me on a special two-year anniversary of Cinephile. Where has the time gone? I mean, unbelievable. When I think back of all the memories, like Adnan getting sick at Sundance and Passmore having promotional sushi with Paris Hilton, I mean, what a whirlwind the last 2 years of film conversation here on the podcast. But I want to go go off the rails here and provide you with a little story from covering a tiny little film in London called The Golden Compass. It has nothing really to do with Cinephile or my love of being a part of this podcast for the last 2 years. Adnan just wanted me to share some weird Hollywood stories with you guys. So here goes. I was across the pond covering The Golden Compass, a movie that I think I liked and relatives of the filmmakers liked, and that's about it. I was interviewing Daniel Craig in a very famous hotel. I think it was the Dorchester in London. And those hotels haven't really been renovated in a while. A little stuffy in those hotels. And as you know, for an interview, there's lots of lights and cameras all packed into a small hotel room. So I would start to get a little moist, if you will. And that moisture turned into a palpable sweat, like a Richard Nixon in a presidential debate type of sweat. And I thought it would be a good idea in my interview with Daniel Craig to hold an ice cube in my left hand, thus keeping me cool throughout the interview and preventing the sweat. Well, what happened about halfway through my conversation with Daniel Craig is that the ice started to melt in my hand and drip down my shirt sleeve. And it became so wet and so runny that James Bond, 007, the coolest man on the planet, said, "Excuse me, can we stop the interview?" Terrible British accent just there. "What is coming down your shirt?" And he proceeded to then spend the rest of the interview making fun of me, calling me the Iceman. I tried to throw in a George Gervin reference. He didn't get it. It just was awkward and horrible. So I sat down with James Bond, the coolest man on the planet, and he made fun of me for 10 minutes. That's my Lion's Den story. Congrats on 2 years of Cinephile, guys. Look forward to another two more. Hopefully more than that.
He's just an average man with an average life. And his reviews dictate that.
Oh, right up my alley. First and foremost.
Playing to my strengths.
Dan Stanzik is...
I thought it was a little much.
Every man.
I love it. It's the best open of the year.
I really resent that open. Get out of here. And his reviews reflect that? Come on, I'm highbrow.
Yeah. By the way, my brother is now in on Along Came Polly because of your review. He was not aware of it. As soon as you mentioned
the sharded... not a superhero movie, so I'm not surprised that he hadn't seen it.
But you mentioned the sharded line. He goes, "All right, I'll watch it this summer."
That's it. Okay, great.
And Ben Koo of Awful Announcing loved the Michael Clayton review.
When did Ben Koo say he liked the Michael Clayton? I think you mentioned that to me. I don't know what you're talking about.
Now, he tweeted it. We'll go back through his tweets. He said, "Cinephile, love it. Really like the Michael Clayton review." There's something else he liked in that episode specifically, but he liked that specifically.
My guy.
Yeah.
All right. Normally you tee this up with like, he did this, and then right. I kind of get right into it. I'm almost like, it's almost like the Greg Cody back in my day.
Yeah, Greg Cody.
I kind of burst onto the scene. So set it up a little and we'll.
Along Came Polly was outstanding, the last one. Michael Clayton was one of the more highbrow ones you did. You also did Con Air? No, it was Gone in 60 Seconds, yeah, which was all right. So now I'm curious where you're going to go with this.
I Love You, Man.
Yes,
a 2009 comedy starring Paul Rudd as Peter Klavan, a newly engaged real estate agent searching for male friends to fill out his wedding party. Peter quickly enlists the aid of his homosexual younger brother, Robbie, played by friend of the podcast, Andy Samberg, and goes on a series of man dates. What he learns, other than to avoid having dinner with another man, is something that most guys who have moved away from home realize in their mid to late 20s and early 30s. Finding new male friends is hard. I mean, outside of coworkers, friends of coworkers, and a potential girlfriend's male friends, the options are pretty limited. Guys rarely express interest in forming new male companions. It's just awkward, and no one does awkward better than Rudd. Peter eventually meets a potential friend at the open house for his high-priced listing, the Lou Ferrigno Estate. Sidney Fife, played by Jason Segel, is there to eat the food and meet the divorcees, but the two of them have a brief chat and exchange business cards. It's at this point where writer and director John Hamburg, who coincidentally also wrote and directed Along Came Polly, uses all of the elements of a romantic comedy, except Peter's pursuit is of Sidney. Instead of telling his friends about the girl he met, Peter tells his fiance and confidant, Zoe, played by Rashida Jones, about the guy he met. The awkwardness ramps up before and after their initial man date. At first, Peter is too nervous to call, and then afterwards, he's unsure about how to call and say he had a good time. Classic rom-com tropes, but the platonic and gender twists make them work. Eventually, we get to a montage set to Tom Sawyer by Rush, Sloppin' Da Bassman, where the friendship accelerates. With things going so well, we need some sort of conflict, right? Well, first, Sidney makes an overt oral sex suggestion to the bride-to-be during a toast at Peter and Zoe's engagement dinner. Then there's a failed co-ed golf date. This is my nightmare. And then a few more issues arise, which I won't spoil for you, but those of you that are familiar with rom-coms know what comes next. Yes, there's a breakup of sorts, which, of course, sets up a reconciliation at the end. I Love You, Man is an hour and 45 minutes of hilarity mining in an important yet undercovered terrain. It has an 83% on the tomato meter at Rotten Tomatoes, and while Rudd and Siegel do the heavy lifting, they are supported by an excellent cast, including J.K. Simmons, the aforementioned Andy Samberg, Jon Favreau, Aziz Ansari, and Jamie Presley. Like any good comedy, its rewatchability is high, and I don't care who you're sharing wine and a summer salad with, it's better than Chocolat.
Great ending. Stuck the landing. I forgot about the supporting cast. I liked it. I saw it once. I had no idea. Aziz Ansari's in it. J.K. Simmons. My favorite part was when Jason Segel shows him his jerk-off station. Passport, you're a fan of I Love You, Man as well?
Same deal. I've only seen it once, but what I do remember of it, I remember it very highly.
Yeah, I liked it as well. All right. Good recommendation from every man. I Love You, Man. Check it out now.
When a film critic and director don't see eye to eye, Rick Passmore goes in defense of.
All right, Ricky, find me guilty. Great. Lumet, Vin Diesel, how are we going to top that?
With the breadth of dystopian narratives revisited in film and television right now, such as The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu and the previously reviewed Fahrenheit 451, I decided to look back at a less serious take on the greater good fascism line of storytelling. 1993's Demolition Man stars Sylvester Stallone, Wesley Snipes, and Sandra Bullock.
Okay, we got to send this to the Levitar show already. They love Demolition Man. Go ahead.
Celebrating its 25th anniversary this October, the sci-fi action flick currently holds a respectable 61% on Rotten Tomatoes, but a paltry 34 Metacritic score, garnering tepid reviews from critics such as David Anson of Newsweek, who states Demolition Man is a movie that should have been fun but isn't. I vehemently disagree with Mr. Anson. Demolition Man acts as an entertaining tongue-in-cheek 90s action flick, as well as a conversation starter on the effects of censorship in society. The film follows Stallone's John Spartan, an LAPD sergeant who is sentenced to cryogenic imprisonment for his negligence while apprehending resident madman Simon Phoenix, played with perfect camp by Wesley Snipes. When Phoenix escapes his own cryo prison during a 2032 parole hearing, Spartan is released to help capture his foe, not just because he knows them best, but also because during his 36 years on ice, Los Angeles has been turned into San Angeles, a squeaky clean utopia of sterilized harmony. It is so neutered from the aggressive nature of the past that everything bad for you has been outlawed, from alcohol and tobacco to cholesterol and vulgarities, to which you are immediately fined just for uttering. Even the police force is so repressed that they have an instruction manual on how to deal with hostiles. They call them, trying to remember what they call them. I think they call them maniacs in the movie. And they even lack the slightest insight on murder death kills, their version of homicide. Enter the testosterone-filled ways of John Spartan, who challenges the mindset of this society, much to the curiosity of Sandra Bullock's Lieutenant Lenina Huxley, who is transfixed with the 20th century and longs for even the slightest action. Lucky her. Yet digging beyond the surface, both literally and figuratively, we are poised with the dilemma of what happens when the world is seemingly purged of all its iniquities. Phoenix is able to escape not just to bring mayhem to the paradise, but to kill off the underground rebellion leader Edgar Friendly, played by Dennis Leary, in another victory for the casting department. Friendly's gangs are seen as blights on the new world, even as Spartan realizes that their crimes are less about upheaval and more about survival. They were outcasts that rejected the sanitized life being forced upon them. While they may feast on carnes de rata and stolen foodstuffs from the surface, Friendly exclaims that he would rather starve than live in a world where there is no free thought and that you live by the way of the ruling class. The clashes of 90s nostalgia and near future absurdities may not date well as we bridge the gap to the San Angeles time frame, but with the awkward fish-out-of-water overtones, solid action scenes, and underlying commentary on the repercussions of utopian life create a cult classic worthy of multiple viewings. To note, Demolition Man is currently streaming on Hulu.
Well done, Ricky. Listen, we got to send that to the Levitard guys because they love it. Stu Gatz and Mike Ryan sits in the Action Hall of Fame. That's how much they love that movie. And I once signed off on a segment by saying be well, and Mike Ryan said that was a reference to Demolition Man. I didn't even know that was. I sometimes say it. What is that from? Who says it?
Everybody. That's their greetings. That's their how are you doing? Be well.
That's unbelievable. I just signed off. I was like, all right, guys, be well. And he goes, oh, Demolition Man from Addy. And I'm like, I'll take the credit for it, but I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, now you know, and knowing is half the battle.
That's their greeting all the time.
All right.
That is indefensive. Thanks, as always, to listening to Cinephile. 2 years in the books. Thanks to Dan and Rick and Ben Lyons and Mark Teixeira and all the great guests like Jay Barros that we've gotten. I just want to – one more guest I want to discuss. Rick, you need to answer this one. Did you listen to the Jerry Bruckheimer interview?
Yeah.
Okay. Because Dan and I are not sure on this, and I want clarity. Do you think he was a great guest and was really into it? Or – because he was very – facile with his answers, very succinct. We weren't sure. Was he just being quick and just want to get out of the way, or does he naturally just speak in very clipped sound bites of 15 to 20 seconds?
I think he's been doing this for the better part of 30 years, and so he knows how to play the press. I think he was very interested in what was going on, and it was a very good interview. It opened your eyes to the type of producer and filmmaker that he is, and honest with the old open where he says, I don't make films for people that go and see
My Dinner with Andre,
which isn't true because I would also watch My Dinner with Andre plus Jerry Bruckheimer films. I have done that. I love Con Air. We love Pirates of the Caribbean, the early ones. So let's be honest. He's not wrong, but he's just a little off base. However, very engaging interview, especially with someone of Jerry Bruckheimer's stature.
Yeah, I remember it was a huge gap for us. I mean, I asked him about Schrader. I asked him stuff. I mean, I asked him the Top Gun stuff. You have to ask him. But I said, it was like 15 to 20 seconds. Just boom. I'm like, all right, well.
Yeah, he had stories, and he wasn't giving them to you.
Yeah. So you don't think he was a good interview?
Like Rick said, I think he's just been so well-trained in dealing with the media over all this time. He knows how to just answer the questions briefly.
Right.
But if he was writing an autobiography, they wouldn't be 15-second blurbs. Like, he's got some stories.
Right.
And he knows where some bodies are buried, and he wasn't telling you. Not that you should take that personally.
No, of course, yeah. But unlike Walter Hill, who I'm talking about Richard Pryor, and he's going into detail about Richard Pryor, what he was like, how he's a pain, but he was friends with him, et cetera. That's fair. All right. All those great guests. Check them out once again on iTunes, the ESPN app. 2 years down. Way to go, baby. We'll talk to you next time. I'll have stories from the Greenwich Film Festival. Hope my deliberations are not like 12 Angry Men. Until then, we'll see you at the movies.
Don't miss out on the next episode of Cinephile. Subscribe to the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast by clicking the Listen tab in the ESPN app.
Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting enrolls for recurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text THIN to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text THIN to 200-300. That's THIN to 200-300. THIN to 200-300.